Welcome to today's deep dive. I mean, I am incredibly glad you are here with us because today we are looking at a source document that essentially proposes a massive ground-up rewrite of how modern institutions operate.
Yeah, it really is a total paradigm shift.
Right. And specifically, it focuses on modern churches. It's this strategic framework titled Metanoia for Missional Leadership. And honestly, whether you are running a nonprofit or leading a community group, or, you know, you're just fascinated by how massive legacy organizations attempt to pivot their core philosophies, the ideas in this text are incredibly thought-provoking.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating structural breakdown.
We're basically going to explore a proposed shift from an inward-looking, self-sustaining model to an outward-looking, community-impacting ecosystem. But before we get into the weeds, I do need to set the stage carefully for you.
Right, because of the specific nature of the text.
Exactly. Because this source material deals explicitly with Christian theology, church strategy, and religious doctrine, we have to make a clear, neutral statement right here at the top. We are taking a strictly impartial, purely analytical look at this document. We are not endorsing or taking sides on the specific religious viewpoints, the politics, or the doctrines presented.
Yeah, that's a very important distinction to make.
Our mission for this deep dive is simply to unpack the strategic concepts and the organizational psychology exactly as they are laid out in the original text. It really does read like a masterclass in change management, just wrapped in theological language.
It really does. And to truly understand the blueprint here, we have to start with the title itself.
Right. The word metanoia, it sounds a bit like a sci-fi concept or maybe a pharmaceutical brand.
It kind of does, yeah.
Yeah.
But it is the foundational definition we need for everything that follows in this framework. Metanoia is a Greek term that is traditionally translated as repentance. But the source material reclaims its deeper, original, and much more expansive meaning. It defines metanoia as a fundamental change in how a leader thinks, how they speak, and what they value in ministry.
So it's not just feeling bad about a mistake.
Exactly. It's not about just feeling bad over a past failure. It is a profound structural paradigm shift in the brain. The text actually quotes Romans 12, which talks about being transformed by the renewing of your mind.
Okay. That makes sense.
So right out of the gate, the author is signaling that this isn't about tweaking a weekend volunteer program or changing the lighting on a stage. It's about a leader fundamentally rewiring their mental models of success.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the author doesn't just leave it at some abstract philosophical level. The text breaks down this massive mind shift into three primary tangible outcomes that an organization should strive for.
Right, gets very practical very quickly.
First up, it talks about raising missional individuals. This is described as bridging the gap between what happens on a Sunday and what happens on a Monday.
Yeah, taking the faith out of the building.
Exactly. It's the idea that faith or organizational values shouldn't be compartmentalized to a weekend service. It needs to connect directly to the daily grind of normal life.
And the second outcome builds directly on that individual shift, moving it to the group level. The goal is for the church to function as a missional community.
So changing how the whole group interacts with the neighborhood.
Precisely. The explicit strategy here is building bridges to the surrounding community rather than walls to keep the community out. It's a shift from a fortress mentality, where the goal is protecting the insiders from the outside world, to an engagement mentality.
Which naturally leads to the third and I think five most expansive outcome, which is engaging in the missional ecosystem.
Right. Acknowledging you can't do it alone.
Yeah. It requires the humility to admit that no single ministry, no matter how massive or well-funded, can transform an entire city by itself.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, achieving those three massive outcomes requires leaders to actively embrace what the document calls 8 distinct metanoia moments.
8 specific shifts.
Yes. These are 8 measurable paradigm shifts that move a leader, and by extension, their entire organization, from the old legacy way of operating into this new missional ecosystem.
And the first of these 8 shifts completely changes the vocabulary and the vision. The text describes it as moving from focusing on building a church to influencing my city.
That is a massive operational pivot.
It sounds great on a bumper sticker, sure, but practically, what does that transition actually look like on the ground?
It changes the primary metric of success entirely. Instead of just trying to grow a congregation, meaning just getting more people in the seats on a Sunday morning, the goal becomes actually having a tangible influence on the city itself.
Moving from internal growth to external impact.
Exactly. The document uses Ephesians 3:10-11 to illustrate the church not as an end in itself, but as an agency of a kingdom within the context of the world.
Like a corporate headquarters.
That's a great analogy. The goal of the headquarters isn't just to get more employees to hang out in the lobby. The goal is for those employees to take the company's products and services out into the market, to actually change the industry.
But using the word kingdom brings a lot of baggage for some people, which brings up shift number two, the transition from preaching solely a gospel of salvation to preaching a gospel of the kingdom.
Right. The text points out that Jesus and the early disciples had one core message, referencing Mark 1:14 and Matthew 24:14, which explicitly talk about preaching the gospel of the kingdom.
But if an organization says they are building a kingdom in my city, that sounds a little intimidating. It almost sounds like a hostile takeover.
The source provides a crucial nuance there, and we really need to highlight this. It explicitly states that this is not triumphalism.
Triumphalism being the idea of taking over the government or the culture?
Exactly. It is not about taking over the world's power structures. The text actually reminds leaders that they are sent as lambs amongst wolves, not as conquerors or political dominators. Furthermore, it clarifies that this isn't about fixing the world so Jesus can return.
So it distinguishes between a rigid, domineering theology and a softer approach.
Right. The target they are aiming for is kingdom alignment, not dominance, but alignment.
I want to push on that phrase for a second, kingdom alignment. What does that actually mean for a normal neighborhood? Because if it's not a takeover, but it is an influence, where is the line?
Let's use an analogy. Imagine a local community center that decides to offer free financial literacy classes, after-school tutoring for kids, and a community garden.
Okay.
They aren't forcing anyone to read a religious text to get a math tutor. They are just genuinely working to improve the neighborhood's baseline of flourishing. That is alignment in this context.
Ah, so creating a better environment overall.
Yes. It means creating environments that are naturally conducive for people to discover faith and live in blessing. It's modeling a way of life that aligns with these values so organically that it positively influences the surrounding environment without any coercion.
That makes a lot more sense. And it requires a very specific attitude toward the city, which is shift number three, moving from condemning your city to seeking the peace and prosperity of it.
This is a huge one.
Because for a long time, there's been a prominent narrative that views the secular city as corrupt, dangerous, and something to be avoided or judged. But the document calls for leaders to actively bless the city.
It relies heavily on a mandate from Jeremiah 29:7. In that text, the Israelites are in exile in Babylon. That is the city they did not want to be in, surrounded by a culture they deeply disagreed with.
Right. They were captives, essentially.
Exactly. Yet the instruction they receive is to seek the peace and prosperity of the city, because if it prospers, you too will prosper.
That completely flips the script on how to interact with a hostile culture.
It really does. The source material points out that God actually designed the concept of the city to draw out the resources of creation, both the natural order and the human soul. The goal of a city is to build environments filled with glory.
It's not just a necessary evil.
No, the document notes that Abraham, in Hebrews 11:10, sought a city whose builder and maker is God. It frames the city as the ultimate canvas for human flourishing.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because shift number four is where we move from lofty ideals to brutal reality. It's the transition from measuring attendance and experience to measuring impact.
This is the operational core of the whole framework.
For decades, the standard metric for success in the organizational world, religious or secular, has been volume, how many people showed up. But this document proposes a devastatingly tough litmus test for an organization's actual value.
It really pulls no punches here.
It says leaders should instead ask, if your church ceased to exist, would the community feel a loss in any way?
That is a harsh mirror to look into. If your doors closed tomorrow, would the neighborhood even notice? Or would it only be the people who attend your weekend program who care?
That sounds great in theory, but isn't measuring impact incredibly subjective? It's easy to count heads in a pew or click-throughs on a website. How does the document suggest a leader actually measure something as nebulous as peace and prosperity?
The text uses a metaphor from Matthew 13:33 to explain this, where the kingdom of heaven is likened to yeast mixed into dough.
Okay, the yeast spreads.
Right. Yeast doesn't just sit in a localized clump in the middle of the bread. It works its way all through the dough, fundamentally changing the chemical structure of the entire loaf.
So it's about systemic change.
Exactly. The framework suggests you measure impact by looking at systemic transformation. You look at the local schools, the poverty rates, the foster care system. Are you addressing spiritual lostness, social pain, and systemic brokenness by taking faith, love, and hope directly into those specific measurable areas?
It's moving from counting heads inside your building to tracking positive interventions outside your building.
Yes, shifting the entire dashboard of success.
But to make a dent in those massive social issues, you can't just have one exhausted leader doing all the work. Which brings us to shift number 5, from encouraging to equipping.
This addresses a major bottleneck in traditional structures.
Many members of a congregation feel that ministry is something restricted to professional clergy. The people on the stage do the work, and everyone else just watches, consumes, and gets encouraged.
The document argues that this consumer mindset is entirely backward, referencing Ephesians 4.1. The actual goal of leadership is to prepare the people for works of service.
Preparing the people to do the work themselves.
Exactly. The phrase they use is paradigm shattering for traditional program management. Leaders must move from seeing people coming to a program to seeing the people as the program.
That completely redefines discipleship.
It does. Discipleship is no longer just about gaining theological knowledge. It's an intentional equipping process with 3 clear outcomes: knowing God, loving people, and impacting your world. It empowers the individual to be the primary agent of change rather than a passive audience member.
I can see how that changes the dynamics of a Sunday morning completely. You aren't hosting a show, you are running a training camp.
That's a perfect way to put it.
But once you've equipped the people, how do those people interact with the culture around them? That is shift number 6, moving from building walls to building bridges. This is based on the mandate in Matthew 5 to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world.
What's fascinating here is how the document categorizes the different ways institutions historically interact with the world. It presents a brilliant 4-part taxonomy that is incredibly useful for analyzing the behavior of any organization, not just a church.
Let's walk through those 4 types of churches because they are so vividly described and really highlight the pitfalls of getting this wrong.
First, you have the protesting church. This institution sees the world as inherently evil and postures itself entirely against it.
They are always boycotting, always angry.
Exactly. The text acknowledges there is a time for a prophetic voice, but warns that protesting cannot become the core identity, otherwise you just become known for what you hate.
It's exhausting, and if you are always protesting the neighborhood certainly isn't going to listen to your message.
Second is the absent church. This is the community that seeks to isolate itself completely.
They just build higher walls.
Right. They build their own parallel society, their own schools, their own media, their own distinct subculture. They abdicate their role in the wider society. And the result? Society simply moves on without them. The institution becomes entirely irrelevant to the real world.
They essentially put their light under a bowl, to use the biblical metaphor. They built the wall so high nobody can see in, and they can't see out.
Then there's the third category, the cultural church. This is when the pendulum swings entirely to the other side.
They just blend in.
Completely. The church completely assimilates the value system of the surrounding culture. What the text calls Babylon. Like a chameleon, it loses all its distinctiveness. It becomes indistinguishable from the world it's supposed to be influencing, effectively neutralizing its own saltiness.
So if the protesting church is fighting the culture, the absent church is ignoring the culture, and the cultural church is just copying the culture, what is the ideal model?
The fourth category is the incarnational church. This is the goal of the entire metanoia framework. It's an institution that is not of the world, but plays a vital, engaged, and distinct role within it.
Balancing grace and truth.
Yes. The text quotes a modern paraphrase of John 1.14. The word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood. Imagine a church that rolls up its sleeves. They are at the city council meetings advocating for the marginalized. They are hosting the neighborhood block parties. They are deeply involved, but they maintain their distinct kingdom-aligned values.
Moved into the neighborhood. I really love that imagery. But how does an organization systematically ensure they are doing that? The document introduces something called the MEM strategy, M-E-M, mobilizing individuals, engaging as the church, and modeling kingdom institutions. Can you break those 3 actions down so they aren't just corporate buzzwords?
Absolutely. Think of it as a 3-pronged strategy for bridge building. First, mobilizing individuals means training the everyday person say, a local plumber or a school teacher, to see their secular job as their primary mission field. They bring those values of peace and prosperity to their daily work.
So that's the micro level.
Right. Then, engaging as the church is the institutional level. That's the church as a unified body, partnering with a local food bank, or running a debt counseling center.
Okay, that makes sense.
And finally, modeling kingdom institutions is the macro level. It means actually creating new structures, maybe starting an adoption agency or a cooperative business that operate entirely on those kingdom values, providing a tangible model for society to look at.
It really requires a different kind of leader to oversee that kind of multi-layered citywide strategy, which naturally brings us to shift number 7, moving from local minister to regional spiritual leader. The document challenges leaders to drastically expand their sense of jurisdiction.
It uses the analogy of Adam being placed in the Garden of Eden with a mandate to tend it and cultivate it. In the same way, leaders are placed in a specific geographical area and they need to take responsibility for it.
Not just their building, but their zip code.
Exactly. A local minister cares about the people inside their building. A regional spiritual leader cares about the welfare of the entire region.
The text mentions Jesus weeping over Jerusalem in Luke 19. He wasn't weeping over a specific synagogue's attendance numbers. He was weeping over the brokenness of the whole city.
Right. His concern was regional, not institutional.
And the document brings in Proverbs 11, which says, "The whole city celebrates when the godly succeed." That strongly implies the wider community, even the people who don't share the faith of the church, should be tangibly benefiting from the leadership of this institution. A lost and broken community needs leaders who initiate real systemic change in their geographic area.
But a regional leader, if they are honest with themselves, quickly realizes they cannot fix a whole region alone. No single entity has the resources, which leads to the final and perhaps most difficult shift for legacy institutions.
Shift number 8, moving from positioning against to joining hands with others.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean? How do leaders who are traditionally used to protecting their own turf, competing for the same limited pool of attendees, suddenly start holding hands?
The framework summarizes this shift brilliantly as moving from ego to eco.
Ego to eco. I like that.
You have to move away from focusing on the ego of the individual leader or the brand of the specific church and shift towards serving the broader ecosystem. The text cites John 17.21, which is a call for deep unity. In Ecclesiastes 4.9, two are better than one.
So it's about collaboration over competition.
Yes. The document argues that joining hands requires a massive dose of humility, a servant attitude, a generosity of spirit, and a strict focus on shared goals over tribal victories.
I imagine theological purity becomes a huge stumbling block here, though. How do you partner with another organization if you disagree on doctrine?
The text makes a very pragmatic point about this. It acknowledges that leaders are not going to agree on every nuance of theology or methodology. There will always be friction.
Right.
But as long as they agree on the core Orthodox perspective and the gospel, they can celebrate its impact anywhere, as the document puts it. We don't have to see eye to eye on everything to work hand in hand on some things.
That pragmatism really is the cornerstone of a functional ecosystem. Think of it like a tech industry ecosystem. Two software companies might be fierce competitors in one area, but they collaborate on open source code because it benefits the entire market.
That's a perfect parallel. It is the realization that collaboration multiplies community impact in a way that tribal isolation never could.
What makes this entire document so compelling is that it doesn't just leave you with these 8 lofty ideals and walk away. At the very end, it provides a practical audit tool called the Power Shift Measurement.
The audit tool is fantastic.
It lists all 8 of these shifts, from building a church to influencing a city, from measuring attendance to measuring impact, from ego to eco, and provides a scale from 1 to 10 for each. It forces a leader to sit down and do a brutal, honest self-assessment.
Let's imagine a leader named Sarah taking this audit for her organization. She might think she's doing great because attendance is up.
Sure, the seats are full.
But when she looks at shift 5 equipping versus encouraging, she has to ask, are my people actually trained to change their workplaces, or do they just like my speeches?
That's a tough question to answer, honestly.
It is. Maybe she realizes she's only a 2 or a 3 on that scale.
Yeah.
By putting a number to these shifts, a A leader can't just pay lip service to the idea of community impact. They have to measure their actual current operational reality against this new paradigm.
It really is a massive proposed shift. We are talking about taking an institution that for centuries has often measured its success by how many people it can convince to retreat into its walls on a weekend and fundamentally rewiring it to measure success by how much tangible peace, prosperity, and service it pushes out into the surrounding city.
It's the journey from a secluded, attendance-obsessed organization to an outward-facing, city-blessing ecosystem. This raises an important question, though, one that I think extends far beyond the realm of church leadership or theology. The source document applies these metanoia shifts specifically to spiritual leaders. But if you take that core devastating metric we discussed earlier, if your organization ceased to exist tomorrow, would the wider community feel a genuine loss? How would that profoundly redefine the way we run any institution in our society?
Wow. If we applied that to the business world, the implications would be staggering.
Exactly. What would happen if a massive tech company, a chain of local businesses, or a public school system measured their ultimate success, not just by daily active users, quarterly profit margins, or standardized test scores,
but by the actual health of the community?
Right. What if they measured success by the tangible peace, prosperity, and relational bridge building they brought to their physical neighborhoods? If we apply this concept of metanoia to the corporate or secular world, we might completely revolutionize what we consider a successful enterprise. We would move from an economy of extraction to an economy of enrichment.
That is something truly worth chewing on today. Whether you are leading a congregation, managing a startup, or just trying to be a better neighbor on your street, asking yourself how you are influencing your city changes absolutely everything. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope this exploration into the architecture of missional leadership gave you a few new frameworks to think about. Keep exploring, keep questioning the structures around you, and we will catch you on the next one.